Yeah, so this is slightly different. I mean, we've boozed ourselves up.
We've got lights. We're in a studio.
We've got wine, most important.
Not cheap wine either.
Yeah, cheap wine in solo cups.
Three black TV producers on a late night Zoom and two cheap bottles of wine later, this podcast was born.
We are ready to chat all things from politics, entertainment, social issues and TV.
Plus everything in between, including our black perspective on life.
I'm Tiana, aka T.
I'm Sienna.
And I'm Gamma. So get ready for some unfiltered lulls, some talk and tears.
As we share our personal experiences.
This is
the In Our Black Opinion podcast.
This is a special episode as we are having a conversation with two amazing black creatives, Tremaine Emery, aka Denim Tears, and visual artist Rhea Dillon. So we'll be talking about Tremaine's recent collaboration with Converse and how his take on an iconic shoe has created a powerful dialogue about the African-American experience.
How are you both today? How are you feeling?
Good, yeah. I'm on you guys' time zone. So yeah, the end of our day, winding down essentially. But Tremaine, you're the opposite.
Yeah, I'm good. Afternoon starting. So yeah, all good.
Amazing. Well, thank you so much for joining us, both of you. Yeah, we're so happy to have you on here.
And just for, you know, our listeners who may not be familiar with your work, but it would be amazing if you guys can actually, you know, tell our listeners what type of creatives you are.
And also how you know each other.
Yeah.
You first, my friend.
I always find this question really tough, or this like description part of things tough. Simply, I'm an artist and a writer from London, from South London. And I know Tremaine, I don't know how we like directly know each other. And so I think we've just had great conversations online and then only briefly met in person a few times, but that's like continued online as well.
Yeah, in LA, I think we first met. Yeah, I mean, Tremaine Emery, born in Georgia, moved to New York when I was 3 months old, and artist, storyteller. I really don't even like. I do titles for other people, not for me. You know what I mean? And but yeah, I like to, fortunate enough to be positioned to make stuff. And, you know, you could also say artist merchant, make stuff that means something to me.
When you see a pair of Chuck Taylors, you're like, boom, that's America. Like, it's such an iconic item of footwear that as soon as you see it, you're like, it's the American dream, it's the American lifestyle, or it's American rockers, or it's like American kids going to the Hamptons for the summer. And you, Tremaine, you've taken such an iconic shoe and not only given it a new purpose, but you've also given it a new identity. So for us and our listeners, we just want to know how you came about with your creative concept.
Yeah, it was first thought when I was approached by Converse to do a sneaker. My favorite Chucks are the stars and stripe ones, American flag one. And so I just wanted to use you know, Marcus Garvey's flag and David Hammond's flags to paint them. Simple idea, but very, for me, very layered. It's also inspired by the Liberty Rock from the neighborhood I grew up in, which is painted in this rock, boulder is painted in the Pan-African flag colors of, you know, red, black, and green. It's been fun to recontextualize such a iconic piece of pop culture with the regalia of my community.
And how did the collaboration come about?
By a very amazing man named Daryl Jackson, also known as Curtains. He was working for Converse at the time as a head of, like, I think he had a position in the design side. And he pushed to have me Chris Union and Shaniqua Jarvis, you know, who also dropped amazing sneakers that represent African-Americans and Black people in general. You know, shout out to Curtains, Daryl Jackson, and then also, you know, another woman, Black woman by the name of Tamara, that works at Converse. She's, I think, the head of design there. She really pushed forward. And then, you know, John Roy, Jesse, loads of people along the way who were championed my shoe. And then it's not just about my shoe, championed me, Chris, and Shaniqua's shoes getting out there. So, yeah.
And do you like the different colors that you've used for the shoe kind of represent anything in particular to you?
The colors?
Yeah, the colors. Do they represent anything to you?
African Americans are displaced, you know, by the transatlantic slave trade. They didn't keep a ledger for us. So I don't know if my family ancestors are from Ghana, Nigeria, you know, South Africa, wherever. So that's why Marcus Garvey made that flag, to give us a banner to unite and stand under and be a, feel a part of, that connects back to where we came from, Africa. Everyone should check out amazing artist by the name of Chris Ofili, that first my dad put me on to, and then later my friend Asa put me on to. But one of his early works were, he paid a lot of homage to David Hammonds, and he did a red, black, and green Union Jack.
Well, the Union Black, it's really fire.
Yeah, it's amazing. You got, well, of course you know. You're amazing. One, it's amazing, but also it's like, it just shows there's a whole lineage of reinterpreting Western iconography and putting the Black gaze on, reflecting the white gaze with the Black gaze. Yeah.
Amen. I've got a little question for you now, Rhea. One of the things that stood out for me was your conversations about kind of the power of art. And it seems like you kind of feel like art had its place in kind of educating people and being a kind of a tool for changing society.
I think it will always speak for itself, and that it is fundamental, you know, in society to have art. It's kind of been hilarious, and obviously we can speak to what our government has been doing recently in terms of trying to portray that we don't need art, or that artists should be retraining because that's, you know, a lesser career or a lesser degree or just not useful, when in fact it's the complete opposite. You know, there's art all around us, and it exists in how we live, how we move, how we speak. So, you know, I think for me, in regard to that, and thinking about, you know, this like little thing that I was excited about when I was younger, which was just like creating and painting and whatever, you know, basically getting messy. Understanding how contextual and important it is to everyone's, like, you know, means of speaking to each other and telling their own stories. I think that's what's so special about art, is especially when we're thinking about the diaspora, so much has been done through art. Thinking about the slave trade, so much was just carried in the movements and the voice that we had, which is, you know, spirituals and then Black dance, and thinking about what Arthur Jaffa said about, you know, culture in America, that is Black culture. It only comes from that. That is all deriving from this artistic license that is probably one of the few things we've been able to carry with us from that time period. So.
And I read somewhere that you said Correct. That your art is your revolution. And I think, Tremaine, actually, you can probably relate to that comment that Rhea made, kind of like, is you guys' art your revolution? Is that how you're revolting in these very strange times?
Yes. I use art, iconography, storytelling to... a revolution needs stories to inspire those to fight against the powers that be. So... I'm not as, I do civic things, but I don't, there are people who do that type of job all day, every day. And those are the most important people, people who dedicate their lives to helping others. My whole life isn't dedicated to that. And maybe when I reach a maybe higher level of consciousness, I'll live my life in that way, but I'm still caught in the grips of consumerism and capitalism and globalization. In Tibetan Zen, like Buddhism, the whole thing it's based on is no one's free until everyone's free. Yeah. And that's their whole modus of, for life is no one is free until everyone's free. So, you know, I'm slowly every day chipping away and just trying to live more towards that way. Yeah, that's my answer.
And what about you, Ria?
I kind of employ the revolt side of things via how I see, like, diaspora children, I call it. So basically us sitting, you know, now. Diaspora kids being tricksters, being able to harness something which is the trickster, if we're thinking of, again, like of iconography and storytelling. And this trickster is someone who quite literally just has to dodge everything that is put in their way. It's kind of like, sometimes I get described as an abstract artist, and I kind of respond, well, blackness is abstract in terms of how society is set up, right? It's set up via this like white supremacist means. And so that means that blackness has to play this trickster of dodging these things and live on the abstract, live outside of this like lineage and this like, you know, single vision.
On the topic of you mentioning diaspora kids, like that term as well, we're seeing for the first time this year, kind of in the wake of George Floyd, specifically children of the diaspora are coming together kind of worldwide. You know, there's this passion that for some people they haven't felt before. It's almost like everybody's being resensitized to something they were desensitized to. Mm. But how do you feel this connection with the Black diaspora kind of worldwide has grown and also has become like more visible?
Yeah, that's a really good question. I mean,
yeah, I
was old enough, I guess, and like old enough and conscious enough should probably be the word, to see the first Black Lives Matter movement, you know, and to watch that and be aware of that. So a lot of, between like friends and I, we've kind of been calling this year as like the uprising, so a second Black Lives Matter movement, right? So I think what's different now is that there's just a heightened level of social media use, perhaps. So it feels more prevalent. And obviously, you know, it's been encapsulated by COVID, which has meant we've all been grounded and just very much like locked to our phones, perhaps even take it as far as obsessed with our phones, which is fine because that's just a means of getting through these days that have been so, you know, unpredictable in terms of movement especially. So I think that's what's made it seem much more heightened perhaps than, you know, previous revolts and uprisings. But I think it's definitely had the same momentum as those previous ones.
And as, you know, like obviously we are children of the diaspora, but I personally come from the point where, even though I am a child of the diaspora, I was born in West Africa. I was born in Ivory Coast, so I have that connection back home. But sometimes children of the diaspora aren't actually allowed to have that connection. It's almost like the connection is stolen away from them.
I'm, you know, African American. My family is from a small town in Georgia, called Harlem, Georgia, and yeah, like, I feel the onus is a double-edged sword. It's on the education system to spot and help kids like myself connect to where they're from. But also the onus is on your family and your community and yourself, you know, like, and it's hard, you know, like everyone can't afford a plane ticket to Africa. Mm-hmm. Or where do they even go? But, you know, there are books, there are documentaries, there are things out there, and there's art that can help you connect. And you have to seek it, you know? You have to meet it halfway. You can't wait for it to come to you. You can't wait for you know, some white scholastic institution to tell you that Picasso jacked African art, you know, African tribal art to make his art. You can't wait for that. You have to go find it on your own. You know, it's part of the journey.
One of the things that we've noticed by having regular conversations with each other is that we're all still learning. So one of the things that we have learned is that our blackness is kind of a universal experience, but it's also something that's quite personal to each of us. We've all had our different lives and experiences of what being black means. So I was wondering what you guys' personal experiences of blackness means to you.
What does blackness mean? I mean, that's such an expansive, but I mean, it's a great question. You know, blackness is my mom's red velvet cake. Blackness is like James Brown having it go on the third count instead of the fourth count, like all the music that came before it. It's, you know, Alice Coltrane, it's all the black single mothers or black women in families raising kids. It is the total experience of our existence from Africa to around the world, from then to now. It's also the thing that is hidden under and to attempt to be held back by Western culture, you know, for ages now. So, yeah, I mean, that's not even the best answer, but.
Yeah, I mean, it's such an expansive question, and then it's so often, you know, I guess, is attempted to be reduced. So I'd say that blackness is just, it's just that, it is the universe.
And just jumping in there, obviously, Tremaine, you said that you lived in London for a while. Was there a different experience kind of living here as a black man? Were there parallels of your life in America? Because often here, people do make the parallels. And a lot of the time, they kind of diminish the black British experience by comparing it a lot. Was there a difference between you living here and kind of living in America as a black man?
Yeah, total 180. Lived around a bunch of black people who were first generation, you know, first or second generation from Jamaica or from either from the Caribbean or from Africa. That's the huge difference, you know, and there's so much pride in that. And race in the UK, which is very existent, but in a different way. And I think that definitely living in London and moving back to America after almost 8 years in London, it informed my creative output, because coming back to America was like literally diving into cold water. And it made me really ruminate even more about what it means to be black in America after being in Exodus in London for almost 8 years. Yeah, it's incredible living in London and being black in London. And yeah.
It's so different. So in the little time that I spent in America, I definitely felt like there was more of a weight on my shoulders. And the minute I kind of came over to the UK, I had a bit more of a spring in my step.
There's a difference, you know, there's a brutality that is taken out on African Americans that isn't the same in the UK. So I definitely felt safer, you know, not just safer, you know, just, you know, there's a brutality that, you know, the government enacts on us. There's a brutality that African Americans enact on each other, which is caught direct collateral damage from systematic racism from the government, from, you know, white male patriarchy power structure that I felt safe and far away from when I lived in the UK, you know? No guns. Not that there's no guns, but it's not like America.
No legal guns.
No legal guns.
You know, there are guns, but not like America.
Yeah.
Black people have, people of color have been beat and killed in the UK. So I'm not taking away from any of that in my next statement, but not at the propensity of America. And that doesn't absolve any police officer that's ever harassed a person of color in the UK or killed someone. But the propensity that it happens at in America is just, I mean, it goes without saying. Actually, it doesn't go without saying because it hasn't changed. So being away from that was surreal as well.
And just honing in to what you just said there about the brutality, we've seen, especially this year, just how the younger generation have literally, it's almost like a call of arms from, you know, Black Lives Matter in the US to ending SARS in Nigeria to, you know, the anti-femicide movement in Namibia and even Black Lives Matter in the UK. There's almost this new kind of like desire and demanding change for the most basic human rights. So what do you feel has been the shift? What's been the catalyst this year?
It's a perfect storm of the decline of Western civilization. The decline in the fissures of and the power structures of globalization, capitalism. The perfect storm of COVID, a worldwide pandemic that's been handled incorrectly by our world leaders. And then the advent, not advent, but the recent advent of social media and technology, which has been able to connect. You know, there's 15 million people that came out in March, in June, and July in America. Who knows how many across the world. And those people were able to connect and have solidarity through Twitter, through Instagram. And, you know, I think also people being on lockdown, you weren't like looking at the murder of George Floyd on your way to your job. You weren't looking at the murder of George Floyd on your way to drop off your kids. You weren't looking at the murder of George Floyd coming out the club at 4 a.m. You weren't looking at it for a second while you're in the movie theater before the, while the trailer's on. You were at home, you had been pondering life, pondering the government, pondering things for 3 to 4 months before we saw this man murdered on Instagram. You know, when when slaves were first brought to America to instill fear, slave masters would hang pregnant women upside down. And I'm sorry to speak about such a grotesque action, but if you can draw a direct line from that action to that policeman's knee on George Floyd's neck. So there's never been a ramping up of the brutality of Blacks in the world or in America. It's been constant. It's never declined, never inclined. It's always been at its zenith. But the storm of COVID, the decline of, you know, capitalism and the fissures in it, late capitalism and COVID and social media, that's why you see the reaction. You see, and we'll see what people are really made of when COVID's over and will people go back to normal, will they continue to push and put pressure on the 1% to change things?
I mean, it's just like Tremaine said, it's so hard to compare this year in terms of people, you know, joining forces because of all of the things that affected this year. You know, those, they can't be separated. They're forever intertwined and locked in with each other. It really was a perfect storm. It's a really great way of describing it. So I think, you know, I would definitely say the UK has been standing up more, and it has been where they've been putting pressure on, you know, their 1% here, of just having like enough is enough. There's also been more time with being inside to really think about what your boss here has been doing, what your boss there had been saying. There's been time to think back to when you were younger and you had, you know, microaggressions against you then till now, and reminding yourself of how they've
probably been consistent and probably haven't changed.
Mm-hmm.
And so it really got to a point where everyone was tired, but also because they were already tired, because this year has been so, you know, stunted.
So you were both mentioning how social media has played a part in kind of making everyone see this brutality, especially what's going on in the US. Do you both feel like social media can be powerful in kind of change, or do you feel like it's performative, problematic? Like, what's your view on social media? Because obviously there was the Blackout Tuesday, and some people saw it as kind of, you know, it felt good to have some solidarity, but what is your personal kind of views on social media and the role that it played this year?
I mean, Blackout Tuesday was started with great intentions to really halt the music industry and to, like COVID did, make everyone stop and really think about how things were being run and to give space, you know, to Black voices. But again, you know, the sickness that is capitalism, the sickness that is white supremacy, it became encapsulated and it became just a, it just became a performance. So I think with thinking of these hashtags, you know, these hashtags are originally created to raise awareness. End SARS is there to raise awareness. It wasn't just it's never been a performance. It's there to actually save lives and to share and tell people what's been happening in other parts of the world. That will always, always be great. The fact that we can access information via something that can just be binaries and codes and hashtags is incredible. But it's when it gets, you know, co-opted oftentimes by corporations to then enact essentially in that moment a portrayal of solidarity without actually doing the work behind the scenes.
Would you let someone drive that didn't have a driver's license?
Which is so, all of us, I think.
I feel social media is a great tool when you know how to drive it. And but a lot of people, that's why I feel like, you know, schools have sex education. It's like there should be social media education from a very early age to set up a wall of knowledge. So especially kids and adults are like knowing like, hey, this is a tool and you can use it, but it also can go a different way, you know? So same thing with anything, a car, whatever, a stove. You just don't hop on it, and, you know? So that's how I feel about social media. I feel like people use it blindly and without knowing the implications, and some people don't.
So on the topic of kind of brands and you know, influencers having social media and the ability to kind of control and everything, we've seen this year kind of brands, publications, broadcasters all saying publicly, we need to do better. You know, they've all kind of taken that oath. We've all got the receipts, they've all said it. So how should brands, you know, what would your advice be? How should brands be connecting with and working with Black creatives?
No talk, all action, immediately acknowledge their part they've played in the state of the world, the state of the world economically and socially. And, you know, white men don't need no more jobs. So if you just go on America, 400 years without getting a job, because let's just talk about Black women. That's probably about how long Black women have been underrepresented. And I'm not about like tit for tat, but I'm just going extreme to say what companies need to do and what the people need to pressure companies to do is just really empower all women of color and also, you know, all men of color, and also get down to the nitty gritty, like, you know, just like, oh, we're going to donate money to the Jamaica Queens basketball team, whatever. No, we're going to, because donating to like the sports program, you continue in the cycle of like, yo, I can make it to the NBA or the wherever NFL and make money and get out the hood. No, let's educate everyone. Let's educate the kids that are dyslexic, the kids that are autistic, the kids that are in single parenthood. Let's not just try to look out for this shiny black pearl that we want to elevate, because normally that's what the white power structure does. They look for the smartest kid in the class, and we gave them a scholarship or the best basketball player. Let's help like the roughest ones, and then that's how communities get changed. So that's what brands and whatever, Converse, Coca-Cola, everyone can do, is really see how they have been implicit in white supremacy since the beginning of industrialization. And what can they do immediately to stop being implicit and complacent with white supremacy, and help out women of color, men of color, LGBTs, so on and so forth.
And I mean, I feel like, Tremaine, your collaboration with Converse is proof of how brands and corporations and publications can say that they're going to do better and show that they're going to do better. So do you want to tell our listeners how it's not just a shoe that you're releasing, but it's also a call of arm for African Americans to go and vote?
Black people educating themselves about the electoral process. Americans in general of any color educating themselves about the electoral process, and how important the African-American vote is. And that importance can only really, whether we vote or don't vote, if we don't vote, our vote's important for the wrong reasons. If we do vote, it's important, possibly for the right reasons, depending on who the majority of us choose to vote. But that vote has power and it is counted. And so that's what the meaning of the shoes become. And, Converse has worked with me and we worked together, and they did great things by pushing up the shoes release date to get it out and before the election. But more important than the shoe, again, working with Four Freedoms and Hank Willis Thomas to make those posters, and dedicating all the marketing to engaging people to vote specifically in the swing states. So it's been great to work with them on this, and I'm happy to be in solidarity with all the other people in the world in America working towards getting people to vote.
And I mean, obviously all elections are important, and we've got to wait a couple of years before ours, sad times, but how do you feel like this election, maybe it is because we are living in this COVID state, but how do you feel like this election feels like it can drastically change the direction of what the world is going in? So for you, being, African-American, what does this election mean to you?
I agree, but I have a different view. So I'm not going to sit and get into all the past presidential candidates or presidents, but Donald Trump, in my opinion, is just a wolf that doesn't wear his sheep's clothing. And that's why his vitriol, is not, cloaked in eloquent words and eloquent slogans. And so I think every election has been crucial. And the most crucial part isn't who wins. The most crucial part is the involvement of the people, and that they know, Democrat, Republican, any side, know that we're watching, we're paying attention, we're paying attention to what the police chief's doing, we're paying attention to what the electoral college is doing, we're paying attention to what the post office is doing, we're paying attention to what the police are doing, we're paying attention to what big tobacco is doing, what the NRA is doing, what the big farm is doing, and we're paying attention, and we're gonna use our money, and we'll hold back our money if we're not getting what we want, and we'll hold back our votes and vote for this person if this person not giving us one. That's what hangs at the thread, is the involvement of everyone that's subjugated and oppressed, So then we put this pressure on these people, and then that will bring the dawn of a new type of candidate. And so then you'll have like amazing Black women like Rhea that are gonna start, their art will be politics. And that's when you'll see change. You know, the change is gonna come from them knowing we're watching and we're not into sleep by retirement plans and Instagram and video games and Hollywood movies and all these things that make us lull us into a false sense of security, you know, because that's what George Floyd and like Donald Trump's like Twitter, it like wakes us up like, oh man, this is effed up. But it's like, you can't tell me Donald Trump's the beginning of the problem. Mm-hmm. You know, like the iceberg was there. Mm. He might be the tip of it. He might be the straw. There was 1,000 straws under it. So what hangs at this, in this impasse of this election isn't about who wins for me, even though it is important who wins, but it's about them knowing we're gonna put pressure on them and we're gonna vote and we're gonna have opinions and we're gonna march and we're gonna boycott and we're not gonna let up this time.
So what are both of your hopes kind of for the future of Black creatives? Like where would you like to see people going, and what change would you like to see happening?
That's a good question. I'd say, you know, from what we've been talking about now is that so many people have been joining in this conversation in this year. So I guess my hope, you know, creative or none, like, or in terms of if you call yourself a creative or not, because I see everyone as being creative. So I think as long as everyone, you know, just continues with the work that they've been doing for the past few months and the engagement that they've been having and the conversations that they've been having, that continued, you know, plight, and it will continue a pressure on these systems that exist. And I think that that point of we'll see next year, like, let's take it there next year. Like, let's keep this up, you know. Mm. I don't want to go back. People keep talking about the word normal and going back to normal. I'd rather live in a post-normal. Mm. That's what I've kind of been looking for. Mm. Because the normal we had was not anything I necessarily felt safe in or comfortable in.
My main hope is two things. My friend Arthur Jaffa told me, he brought up this thing. It was in a video or a thing he did with the imagery of a goat. And he said, this is the Judas goat. He says, the Judas goat is the goat that walks the sheep into slaughter, but the Judas goat keeps walking out and goes and does it again. And I hope for the Black creatives, especially African-American creatives, that we cease to be, like, example, this is no disrespect to Michael Jordan, but to me, Michael Jordan's a Judas goat, and not by choice. He's a Judas goat made by the system, in a sense that millions of young Black boys maybe sacrificed education or other dreams because they saw Michael Jordan become great, but really they were just being led to the slaughter because there's 300 spots in the NBA. 300, and there's 30 million Black people in America. Yet that's the thing we hold the highest. So that's the thing I would hope for, like, all the Black creatives and vanguards, is to not lead our people or anyone into the slaughter anymore of thinking that our path is the path. And there's a lot of paths for Black people to be great and do things, not just you know, sports and music and stuff like that. And we can do anything. We have done everything. And then my other hope would be that that we no longer seek validation from Western totems, not seeking validation from Vogue or the Whitney Biennial, and feel just as great about our artwork if it's in an all-Black gallery that's in the Mert Park as we would if it was in the MoMA. And that's my highest hope, is for us to only seek validation from internally and that external Western accreditation. Those are my two hopes. I appreciate this whole talk and everything. It's been great.
It's been amazing. It's
I wish all my interviews and talks were like this.
It's okay. We could do some more. Don't you worry.
Amazing. That's it, guys.
Yeah. It's been an amazing chat. And we just want to say thank you for just taking the time out of your evening and your day to, like, just talk with us about, you know, blackness.
Yeah.
It's just nice and it's just refreshing. And from a personal point, I just want to say one of the projects that you did, Ria, regarding Afro hair. So even though I've got braids on at the moment, I usually rock an Afro. And it's just so refreshing to see that my natural hair can be used to tell the Black experience. Mm. So for that, I just want to say personally, thank you.
Oh, no, you're welcome. Yeah. No, thank you for saying, and thank you for having us, you know, to sit and talk. We don't usually, Tremaine and I don't usually get to talk like this, so it's nice to have this discussion and be really open and, you know, in the different houses that we're in right now and around the world to have this, like, space to converse and talk and still know that we're all sharing in our thinking and our discourse is really nice.
Yeah, it's amazing.
Well, thank you so much, guys.
Thank you, ladies. Goodbye.
Thank you. Bye.
So that has been a very insightful conversation, and I think one of my favourite conversations of this year.
So interesting.
And it's just nice as well, I think, to also have, you know, the American Black perspective, and it's not just us pretending that we know about American life. So there you go, guys.
It's so nice to have guests.
I don't know about you guys, but I literally want to be best friends with both of them.
I know. It's fine. We'll stalk them on Instagram afterwards.
So that's it this week. Thank you so much for tuning in for another episode of the In Our Black Opinion podcast. If you enjoyed listening, please like, share and subscribe to our content. As always, if you have any suggestions or even just fancy a chat with one of us, just slide into our DMs. Thank you again, and we hope that you listen next week.